from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll welcome the new Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra music director, Matthew Kramer, to Indianapolis.
I'll take a look at what is going on at VSA Indiana this summer.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Indie Jazz Fest, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Of roads led conductor Matthew Kramer to his new post as music director of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. Sharon Gamble invited the maestro to our studio to welcome him to town and learn about his background.
So you're from Indiana originally, I understand.
I am a Hoosier, Richmond, Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And Indianapolis was in every possible way the formative hub of my musical education, even in high school. When I knew that I loved the violin, I loved music, I was over here for youth orchestra rehearsals every Sunday with the New World Youth Symphony with Susan Kitterman.
Yeah.
And was studying violin with Larry Shapiro at Butler in my junior and senior year. So that's obviously made the college discussion, the short list, very short.
Absolutely. And wow, that's kind of prophetic, because Larry was for many years the concertmaster of the ICO.
So in so many ways all roads lead back home. They all do, it really seems, because that was, of course, the orchestra that I saw on a regular basis as a student at Butler. And it wasn't just Larry. Then I studied with Davis Brooks as well.
Mm-hmm.
Chaba Daly, the principal violist of the orchestra, I studied viola with him. David Murray, I had chamber music sessions with David. So I'm looking at an orchestra from the podium now that I, you know, many musicians who were either friends of mine, colleagues and or teachers of mine, so it is a very unique experience.
And when you were auditioning for this post, it could have been also a little scary thing. Oh, a bunch of those people know me.
It was surreal. Thankfully, I have about 13 years of professional experience under my belt that I have stood up in front of very intimidating very intimidating environments before, and so this really did feel very comfortable, because this orchestra really is such a warm group of musicians who just enjoy playing together. They made the whole audition experience, which can be and usually is, very stressful for a conductor. They made it feel very natural.
Yeah, because you have to come in and get to know these people in about 5 minutes.
It's like being on the worst first date you can imagine, where everyone is just scrutinizing you. You stop and you try to rehearse a section, and people are writing notes on their stand. Like, you know, I remember in one situation, I wanted to stop and work with the French horns, and they were all, you know, bells on their knee, just shaking their heads no to me while I was talking to them. So, you know, this is my conductor colleagues and I share stories about in our bruises and our scars from these kinds of situations. But it is an extremely important decision for any orchestra who the artistic director will be and what their vision is and how they work with not only the musicians, but of course with the board and with the staff and in the community. So it's important that it is heavily scrutinized.
You know, you mentioned made the comparison to a first date, and it is a very, I know our listeners will take this in the right context, it's a very intimate relationship musicians have with one another in an ensemble.
It is very complicated at times, but also a very powerful bond, because, you know, you're creating this art and you're doing it in ways where you're not speaking, you know, with your voice. You're speaking with your instrument. And these are highly educated, very talented individuals who have very strong opinions about the music that they're playing. And so my philosophy, when I'm often asked, how would you describe your conducting? It's not what you look like, which is very hard to describe anyways. I let other people describe that. But it's more about a philosophy and what you bring to the table. And I really do believe the first word I always use is a collaboration, because you're not dictating, which was very much the style of conducting even 50 years ago,
yeah,
certainly before that. but trying to draw the best out of them, to create the best possible environment for the musicians to perform their very best. You have to have strong ideas about what it is that you're conducting. You have to have a vision for the piece, but at the same time, you need to create that atmosphere. And you're right, that connection needs to be as healthy as possible between the podium and the musicians, but amongst themselves as well.
Do you ever worry about maintaining a little bit of distance? Do you need to maintain a little bit of distance?
Yes, you do. But I just tell the musicians that, you know, when we get into conversations, I want that to be as natural as possible. I don't believe in putting up any facade about my personality. I'm a Hoosier. I'm proud of it. I studied a little bit in Europe, but I don't have a strong German accent. My name is not spelled with an umlaut. You know, a lot of conductors have deeper resumes than I do too. But I'm very much comfortable in my own skin, and I have a thick skin. And I believe in being close with the musicians to a certain degree. But you still have to. You have to be very pragmatic about how you approach rehearsals, and you can't ever let people assume that you have favorites in the orchestra, or that there's somebody who you always let get away with something because you don't want to address this and that. It's just more about, I think, being an artistic leader of an orchestra means that you have to, you know, you have to keep yourself to very high standards.
It's like being a good teacher or a good parent in some ways.
There's so many similarities.
Yeah. So tell us the path you took. You obviously were drawn to the violin and its cousin, the viola. But where did conducting come into the picture? When did you think, oh, well, gosh, that looks interesting?
I think almost by complete accident.
Really?
It was just something that kind of came along in my studies at Butler. Stanley DeRuscia, a marvelous conductor, my first conducting teacher. I took in some independent studies with him because as an undergraduate, there are no programs in actual conducting, which is kind of one of those strange things of how do you become a conductor in a master's program without any real experience as an undergraduate. But Stanley was very, very accommodating for an inquisitive young mind like me to give me some pointers. But really, the answer to that question is that I was more intrigued with the score, with reading a full score. As a violinist, as you know, you're reading one line. As a cellist, the same thing. Pianist, you have the two lines. But, you know, really for me, it was how do all these voices fit together and the complexity of it. All these musical languages, B-flat clarinets, F horns, alto clef, bass clef, tenor clef. And it was just daunting. And so I started to take some small amount of piano lessons just to be able to reduce scores and everything. But it was more the musical element was driving me as opposed to catching the conducting bug and wanting to wave my arms in front of people. But the first couple sessions, I did bribe my friends with pizza and you know, drinks and come play and watch me make a fool out of myself. I have these old videos on VHS, and I cherish them. Because, you know, every once in a while, once a year, I'll pop it to one of those tapes in with a glass of wine and just marvel at how awful I was. And then the same thing, you know, you practice conducting the CD of the Berlin Philharmonic, and the CD always sounds so good. And you just try to choreograph your moves in the mirror. And, you know, again, I look back on that some 16, 17 years ago and just marvel at how little I actually knew about the conducting profession.
So it strikes me one of the difficulties in learning to conduct is you really do have to speak the language of all the instruments in the orchestra. There's no possible way any conductor could learn to play something from every section. But how did you tackle that challenge?
Well, very fortunate in that in my undergraduate and graduate studies that just to be able to talk to musicians who do play those instruments, that you just have some knowledge of the instrument, the mechanics of it. What are some of the problems with an individual instrument that might make this passage difficult, for example, playing across the break on a clarinet, for example.
What is that?
It's a certain range on the staff where you cross over from a lower range to a higher range, and anything that's kind of written around that space or jumps around makes it very difficult to navigate. Same thing with, you know, with horn. Just, you know, if you have a stopped horn, you put your hand in the bell, and what are some problems inherent in that? Really, my knowledge of all of these instruments, you know, I also glean from orchestration books as well. But really, the conversations, what I found is that, you know, you have to have obviously a much greater knowledge of these instruments if you're teaching them. If it's something at, you know, obviously the elementary or high school level, even to some degree in college as well, certainly for these courses where you're teaching education majors. But what I found very early on as a professional conductor working with wholly professional orchestras is that they don't need you to teach them how to play their instruments. Mm-hmm. They are perfectly capable of playing at an extremely high level. What you need to do is be able to communicate them in musical terms. What is it that you're looking for? And that's what I found has been the case for my entire professional career, is that I've never actually had to engage in any technical discussion with a flute player about their nature of their instrument. I just ask for purely musical terms, and you know, I might get that's a little too fast or a little too slow, but you know, all of this is part of the my development as a musician and as a conductor.
Do you have any time to still play violin?
I do. I think Elaine has actually asked about that on several occasions, how my chops are. But I was able to keep them up at a pretty high standard. I'd say probably the best that I felt my playing was about 2002 when I first started my conducting career. Played chamber music extensively, and even when I began with the Virginia Symphony, when my schedule became much more hectic, still played chamber music. But for the past 6 years, the schedule has just been brutal. There's always been a pile of scores on my desk that I've had to go to. And really, the only time that I have to play is in the summer months for a couple of weeks here and there. But I have forced myself this past season to get back in shape. And it's just, it's terrible. The mind knows what it wants, but the fingers just don't respond. And I did play the Schumann Piano Quartet about 2 months ago, which was lovely. My fingers were throbbing afterwards, and my body was stiff. But it felt good to get back to actually physically making music, because as a conductor, you're not. You know, it's all in your mind and how you relay that message to the musicians, but you shouldn't be making any sounds as a conductor.
So you're going to be, have been, and will continue to be in front of hundreds and thousands of people who are there to absorb this amazing music. And I know you have some thoughts about how you'd like to do that beyond simply being, not that it's simple, but being on the podium and conducting. What kind of audience outreach are you envisioning?
That's the hot ticket right there, that we have to be able to get out of our concert hall, which is a gorgeous concert hall, and to do more. And I think orchestras all over the country realize that in our case, our 7, 8, 9 concerts, whatever it may be, that we are in our facility playing, you know, for our audience. That's really the foundation that we're built on. But this outreach, for example, an outdoor program at Holiday Park, it's a beautiful form of outreach to be able to reach a segment of the population that may never have set foot in the Schrott before, but they're now aware of who we are. They saw us in action. They saw a free concert with food vendors there. That's a form of outreach.
And they could bring their families, too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Right? We saw children there. They had their pets there. I mean, you can't bring your dog in the Schrott.
Not yet.
We can't get past that. But those are all forms of outreach. Of course, we're going to closely re-examine what our education footprint looks like, how we're going to be taking our programs into the school. And this is something that I've had an incredible amount of success, if I can say so. In Buffalo, our education programs reached over 40,000 students in Western New York. And it wasn't just in our concert hall. We had runouts. We did live broadcasts every year, so the video was streamed into school districts that were an hour and a half away from Buffalo, so they were able to see a free concert that they never would have before. All of our programs are designed to meet state curriculum so that they tie into STEM, that we can design programs based on all of these things that are heavily scrutinized in academia now. And then again, it's really about getting the brand of the ICO out there in the community as much as possible, creating as much recognition for this phenomenal orchestra, which really, in my opinion, sells itself with what we do. And we just have to be able to actively engage our community in any way that we can find possible. And that might mean in really looking at ways of getting outside of Indianapolis as well, to taking what I really believe is and will be one of the finest chamber orchestras in this country, to increase its statewide recognition and even national recognition. We can do that.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's new music director, Matthew Kramer. Learn more about the new season of the ICO and about Maestro Kramer at icomusic.org. Again, icomusic.org.
Listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The mission of VSA Indiana is to transform the lives of people with disabilities through the creation of art. This summer, VSA is going through some transformations of its own. Travis DiNicola spoke with Gail Holtman, president and CEO of VSA, to find out more.
Gail, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Hi, Travis. Thanks for having me here.
You are very welcome. Lots of big things, transitions, transformations coming to VSA that I'm excited to talk with you about. Before we jump in all that, let's do the overview of exactly what is VSA Indiana. So you've been around for 25 years.
Actually, even a little bit longer than that. So VSA Indiana has had several names over its life, which has sometimes made it challenging for people to keep up with us. But we are a statewide nonprofit that serves people with disabilities through the arts, based here in Indianapolis in the Harrison Center at 16th and Delaware. And so we not only have studios there, but also then, of course, serve people around the state in various places.
Sure. And you work with all ages, right?
We work with all ages and all abilities. And inclusion is really an important part of our philosophy. So we're not trying to further segregate people with disabilities by only serving them in our programs. So anyone is welcome. And depending on the program, we typically have about 80 or 90% participants with a disability and then 10 to 20 without.
And you often do programs where maybe family members will come together, one with disabilities or one not, and sort of working together on different projects, right?
Absolutely. Family members, friends, neighbors. It's really a wide variety of folks that we're serving.
And it's visual arts.
Well, no, we do all the art forms. We just tend to do a lot of visual arts. And there is a demand for visual arts, particularly clay. The clay studio is a very popular place. We go through a lot of clay and a lot of glaze. But really, all the art forms are available, and we're actually trying to figure out how to do more music and more movement and more drama.
I think a lot of people may know you through when the Harrison Center has its open houses once a month. You guys have a little shop there with often a lot of clay works as well as other things on display made by people who participate in VSA.
That's true. We are a member of IDOTA and so part of First Fridays. And our gallery is in the hallway, the main hallway that a lot of people use to enter the building. And so we have there the work of our students and then also the work of adults, work of school children, really a wide variety of students that, that work in and through VSA programs.
How do people get connected to you normally? Is it through schools or through other programs or?
There's a variety there as well. We do a lot of school work and so have a lot of connections with teachers. A lot of parents, a lot of group home staff, medical folks. It's really a wide variety of folks who know about us and then refer people to us.
Give me an example of, we talked about clay, but of maybe another class that's a popular one or an interesting one that you offer.
Sure. Well, we do some drumming. And, you know, I think going back to just to say a little bit more about the clay and the visual arts, I think the reason why we do so much of that and why it's in such demand is that it's very tactile. It results in something tangible. And it just is really an engaging activity like that. And so in a similar way, I think drumming, we have a lot of percussion instruments and drums, and it's very hands-on and it has this kind of immediate creative, activity that you get out of it. So that's another thing that we do regularly.
Very cool. Very cool. And again, the classes are offered to everybody.
They are. We have 5 8-week sessions a year. And everyone is welcome. Sometimes we'll have a class that we'll say is primarily designed for adults or sometimes primarily designed for a younger elementary age student. But and, you know, there are good reasons to do that kind of grouping. But for the most part, they're pretty open and flexible to ages and abilities.
And there's tuition, or how does that
there
part
is.
Work?
Everyone pays tuition. We use a sliding scale, so it's based on household income and household size. And we would never allow the cost to be a further barrier, so we always have scholarships. But a lot of people pay $20 for an 8-week session.
That's really reasonable.
It's very reasonable. Mm-hmm. And of course, then we fundraise to make up the difference.
Excellent. Excellent. And schedule of classes, is that on your website?
It is on our website at vsai.org.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Okay, so you have been around for a number of years, have gone through different names. Some people remember you as Very Special Arts Indiana and now VSA Indiana. The organization is also part of a national network, right?
This is true. So VSA, or Very Special Arts, was founded at the national level by Ambassador Jean Kennedy Smith, and it was her sister who founded Special Olympics. And the Kennedy family has a very personal connection to disability, and mm-hmm. also, a family member started Best Buddies. So there's a lot of connections there at the national level between the Kennedy family and disability, and so that's true for us as well. And so, yeah, the organization has been around for about 30 years, nationally okay. about 40 years. And we are evolving, I guess, along with the folks that we serve.
Mm-hmm. And part of that evolution includes a new name?
It does include a new name. We have been working over the last couple of years to really kind of delve into, you know, what is our vision? Where do we want to go? Who do we mm-hmm. want to serve? What do we want to be? And it's been a great conversation. It's complex. The work that we do is complex. Art is at the center of everything we do, but it's not about the art. People with disabilities are at the center of everything we do, but it's not about their disability. So when we really started thinking about how to brand ourselves, it was a complex conversation.
And it's not exactly art therapy either, what you do.
It is not art therapy, and I'm glad you asked that, because we have sometimes people who talk about our work as therapy. We know that there is a therapeutic effect to a lot of the different programs that we offer, but we are not art therapists, mm-hmm. and that is a particular field of study, a profession, mm-hmm. A skill set that we don't offer. So that's an important distinction to make.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of time people think just because art is therapeutic, whether it may be in like a situation like VSA or a retirement home or something, that it's art therapy. But that's a totally different thing, really, in terms of much more of a branch of psychiatry and psychology. But what you do, it's not exactly about the art. It's not just for people with disabilities. So it's a mix of a whole lot of things, which I'm throwing you a softball here, leads to the new name.
Absolutely. Thanks, Travis.
Sure, you bet.
Let me write that line down. So, yeah, so we've been working to come up with a new name that we are going to formally unveil on July 22nd.
Okay.
And so we will be transitioning to a new name that is ArtMix, Art Redefining Disability.
ArtMix. So ArtMix is the main name, and then sort of the sub title of the branding is Art Redefining Disability.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So tell me, I mean, you gave some sort of the background of how you came to that, but tell me a little bit more about that name and what that tag means as well.
Sure. Well, so we had a really long conversation about trying to come up with a name that explained quickly what it is we do without further branding the folks that we serve. So again, if you go back to the comment I made about disability, people with disabilities are at the center of what we do, but it's not about their disability. In fact, the work that we do always moves beyond or around or beyond the real or perceived disability that our students have. So when we were thinking about the name, we were trying to figure out how to caption ourselves in a way that would make people proud, wouldn't further brand them as a participant of something that they may not want to associate with. You know, it's very interesting when you talk to people with disabilities, some folks are very interested in their identity as an individual, whatever that might be, as an artist, as an attorney, whatever it might be. And their life as a person with a disability is just a component or secondary to them. There are other folks with disabilities that you talk to that their disability is very much a part of their identity. And so it's very complex, just like
sure.
the rest of us. So at any rate, so that was very front and center to us. We came up with a name and a tagline, and we floated it out to a few funders just to kind of get their reaction. And the first reaction was, are you changing your mission?
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, oh, we need to go back and retool this. And what we decided was we needed to address that the organization's focus is on a person with disability right on in the name and tagline of the organization, but in a way that was in keeping with our values, and we value respect. So that's how we got to ArtMix, Art Redefining Disability.
Hmm. Very interesting. What an interesting process you've gone through.
It was a great process. We had a team of artists, of staff, of board, of volunteers. We talked to First Friday attendees, our own students, and we did a lot of research. And it was a really wonderful component almost of strategic planning.
Now, you're launching the official name and new logo and everything at a party coming up on July 22nd, but I'm sure you must be getting feedback already, especially from students. What are they saying?
Well, so far, everything that we've heard is positive and very excited. Almost there's a slight envious tinge to what we're hearing, like, oh, darn, wish we'd come up with that. So it's been very positive. You know, change is hard, and the Very Special Arts name is a throwback to a time when we used to talk about people with disabilities as very special. And, you know, really all people are special. And we're trying not to focus so much on the disability at VSA, soon to be ArtMix, but more about the abilities present. Mm-hmm. So we've really heard only positive things about it. And yes, you're right, there is a party on July
22nd. Yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah, because this is going to be a great way to celebrate what ArtMix is becoming.
It's going to be wonderful. So anyone who is familiar with our organization might recall that every summer we have a summer open house. It's open to the public. This year we've just kind of pumped it up a little bit. And so it's our 2015 Arts for All Festival. It's a free, family-friendly, inclusive arts festival. We will have creation stations, which is a way to say that our teaching artists will be there to include all sorts of people in drumming and clay making and collage and painting and storytelling, all sorts of things. We received a grant from the Indiana Humanities Council, and they have a really interesting project that they're running, trying to increase civic engagement around the state, and it's called All In.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with it?
I am. It's a great program, yeah.
Yeah, I think
it's a lot of fun.
Too.
It's an interesting way to sort of get people to participate in unusual, interesting ways and things that are already going on in their community.
Yeah, I think it's a little stroke of genius. So we have 10 organizations that are partnering with us, and they'll be there on July 22nd, and they range from civic theater to indie fringe to Midtown Mental Health and Special Olympics. To the Peace Learning Center, to the Harrison Center for the Arts. And I can't mention everybody here, but we've got quite a lineup of folks who are going to be there that day. And they're, of course, interested in reaching the folks that are going to come to the festival, but they're also going to be posing a question as part of this all-in challenge and helping people answer some questions.
So for that night, for this event, give me the time again. It's on July 22nd.
It's Wednesday, July 22nd, and the time of the event is 4 to 8 p.m.
Okay, and people need to register ahead of time?
They do need to register. It's free, but we want to have a head count so we know what to do about food and drink. So in order to register, you can go to our website, which is vsai.org, and click on the news and events tab at the top banner, and that will give you a link in order to register.
And again, that VSAI website, of course, is active, but you're also going to have a artmixindiana.org website coming soon, right?
We will indeed. And, you know, we're going to refer to our former name for probably a year to help people transition. And I should say, you know, for anybody who's really familiar with VSA as a national network of state affiliates, we are proud to serve as the Indiana affiliate, and we're committed to remaining part of that network. So we will continue to do that. And that's also important. I mean, we used to have to use the VSA name, and there's been a change at the national level, so we no longer have to use that name. And we really felt it was important to have a name that, you know, people could really quickly get excited about.
Yeah.
So that's
well,
where we are.
Congratulations. It sounds great.
Thank you. We're very excited.
Yeah. Well, that'll be a great event on the 22nd as VSA Indiana transitions into ArtMix, Art Redefining Disability. Gail, thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter today.
Thank you very much, Travis. Appreciate it.
Travis DiNicola with Gail Holtman, President and CEO of VSA Indiana. To find out more about VSA, visit vsai.org, vsai.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Do you want some watermelon?
Sure. I love watermelon.
I have a little bit left over. There's one extra watermelon we didn't get into on our 4th of July celebration last weekend. So I have some to share. And you know what? I have enough to share with our listeners
yes.
as well. So they can eat some watermelon while we do that calendar we call.
What do we do? I just made some lemonade with watermelon.
Oh, my gosh.
It was really good.
That sounds spectacular.
Very yummy. And I love pickled watermelon rinds.
Oh, me too.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff.
I didn't know that about you.
We've been
working together forever, and
you
I didn't know that
learned
about
something.
You.
Hey, you know, a great place to eat some watermelon is going to be on the porch party.
What a segue.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's the Harrison Center's porch party. It's their second annual event. And it connects with the show that they have going on at the City Gallery. But they're doing a really cool thing where basically different people are opening up their porches and having parties on it to meet your neighbors in downtown Indianapolis. And it's all part of that crazy creative mind of Joanna Taft at the Harrison Center. You can get more information, of course, at the Harrison Center's website or a hashtag Porch Party Indy.
Porch Party Indy. Love it. And there's, by the way, if you're at... driving in Midtown Indianapolis, there's a fabulous billboard painted by Kyle Ragsdale
yes.
at 16th and Pennsylvania up there on the...
Delaware, it's cool.
You're right, Delaware, sorry. Mm-hmm. Northwest corner there. So if you catch that light, take a look at that. Hey, I'm going to test your trivia here. Do you know what the best-selling rock song of all time was until Radioactive surpassed it?
I do not.
Do you have a favorite Journey song?
Does Journey have more than one song? Really? Yes, of course they used to. Well, I'm not going to stop believing in this one, Sharon.
I love that. So if you want to believe, you might want to go to Marsh Symphony on the Prairie this weekend, Friday night at 8, Saturday night at 8. Brent Havens is the guest conductor, and he's got this kind of niche market in leading symphonic rock programs. He's done music of Led Zeppelin, The Doors, Pink Floyd, Queen, Michael Jackson, U2, The Rolling Stones, and others. And one of those others is Journey, who is the featured artist this weekend. Don't take me wrong, the band Journey will not be here. These will be covers of Journey tunes played by the ISO. But wow, what a fresh new way to interpret maybe some of your favorite rock and pop tunes at Symphony on the Prairie this weekend, the music of Journey.
And now I've got that song in my
mind.
I'm
so sorry. Start thinking about Radioactive instead.
Right, there we go. Hey, speaking of other music, and I know you're going to be talking about Indie Jazz Fest in just a little bit, Sharon, but there's a lot of jazz going on this summer, including Animals and all that jazz at the Zoo. It's back and swinging for its 28th year. There's so much fun. Thursday nights at the Zoo, the concert series is from 5:30 to 8:30, and this year they're having some really cool food stations. Of course, beer sampling from Sun King is there as well. Animals are on exhibit until 7 p.m. Rides are open until 7, and it just kicked off last weekend with Brenda Williams, but coming up this July 16th, West Central Quartet. It's sort of a high-energy pop jazz group, and they're going to have Taste of Summer-themed food stations with beer can chicken and salad bars and apple dumplings. Then later on this summer, Mina and the Wondrous Flying Machine and Appalatin, and then Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra wrapping things up. But really neat. Check out the Zoo's full schedule to find out all the musicians and all the food that goes along with it.
And find out what animals they allow to stay up late to dance.
Yes.
To the jazz. Hey, speaking of animals, this is a water animal. Lobsterpalooza is coming up to benefit the Indianapolis Opera. It's next Saturday. That's July 18th. It's at the Frank and Katrina Basile Opera Center. And it's just a fun night to benefit a great cause, and lots of delicious lobster.
Yummy.
You gotta love lobster.
Nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Hey, last thing I've got: if you're making a visit to the Children's Museum this summer, you may want to check out their theater because they're doing The Emperor's New Clothes as a musical comedy, and that is running through August 2nd at the Children's Museum at different times throughout the day. Should be a lot of fun.
Well, eat your fair share of watermelon, and remember, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And we'll be back next week with more things you can see, do, eat, and enjoy on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Indie Jazz Fest is celebrating the art of the song this coming September. Sharon Gamble invited Rob Dixon and David Ali in to learn about the Jazz Fest Signature Series performers and about an unusual fundraising event that's coming up on July 19th.
Hey, so Indie Jazz Fest, 17 years, and,
yep.
yet you're so young. Now, I know you weren't both there at the beginning as like the Chief Charles in Charge guys, but you've been involved in Jazz Fest for pretty much its whole time.
Been involved either playing or going to, or being a patron watching. So I think I actually played the second one, or maybe I played the first one. I can't remember. It was the first one. I played the first.
Wow.
In a small tent.
You can say you were there back in the day.
Yeah.
but your official roles now are, Rob?
I'm the artistic director of Indie Jazz Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And festival director, I guess, would be
festival director.
The official title.
The official title. But we know how these things work. You both do everything, and you have
some partners. There's a lot of trash to be taken out. There's floors to be scrubbed.
Yes. Exactly. Hey, how'd you come up with the subtitle this year for the Year of Song?
Well, I think we were looking at it kind of comes out a little bit out of guilt. The last few years, we've wanted to get more vocalists on the festival, and for one reason or another, scheduling or budget or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just weren't available at our time. So we kind of made a conscious effort to make sure we were inclusive of a few more vocalists. I mean, we had some great vocalists the last few years, stuff at the cabaret and whatnot. But,
sure.
But this year we're featuring, at least two out of the three of our what we call our signature series performers, Tick Six and mm-hmm. Diane Reeves, are, world-renowned vocalists.
Absolutely.
And, at the top of their game. And so we feel like it'd be nice to have a little title. People, kind of connect with that. But there's also some threads throughout, they'll probably end up being a Cole Porter thing on there. There's vocalists kind of throughout the thing. It's Frank Sinatra's 100th birthday this year, so there'll be kind of something nod to him as well.
So,
there's a lot of things that just kind of ended up being in the vocal realm, and so the Year of Song seemed fitting.
Yeah, absolutely. Take Six, that's kind of a catch to get them here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they were kind of, when they first hit the scene, larger than life, and it kind of catapulted Brian McKnight to the success that he has right now. So they're just a group that's world-renowned. Yeah.
So I've always wondered, I should know this and I don't, is the name Take Six, obviously it's based on the number of performers too, but is it a little bit of a tribute to Take Five? To the tune?
They do everything in 6/8 instead of 5.
Right. Actually, yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
They changed their name.
Yeah.
Their name was changed, actually. In college, they were a different name, and I don't remember what the name was. But when they kind of got their big commercial break, that's when they said, we need to come up with a snazzier name.
And there were six people in the group. So.
So, if anybody listening is like, I don't know them, Who might you compare them to?
You know, it could be like the Manhattan Transfer, New York Voices, but with a little more probably gospel influence on it. But it's basically jazz, you know, vocal acapella.
Acapella, hard stuff.
Yeah.
They're actually one of the of all the groups out there, they're one of the most awarded groups, you know, as far as Grammys and Dove Awards and different awards. I mean, it just kind of goes on and on.
Gambit,
so they're
awards,
very
Soul Train
critically
Award.
Acclaimed and obviously a lot of veteran performers, and like you said, a very huge gospel influence as well.
Yeah, a lot of energy. Feel good kind of music.
I think a lot of times, like a lot of these vocal a cappella groups have take from them, they're kind of pioneers in that whole genre of a cappella jazz, because of the way they use their voices is instrumentation. A lot of times people say, okay, well, we'll just have the bass play the bass line, but then they have other instruments, you know, the voices mimicking other instruments as well, that has kind of become a thing in the vocal jazz world, you know, and I think they kind of led that or pioneered that whole practice of, you know, not just having vocals for just the words, but for mimicking instruments. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
It's kind of almost like all of them are like Bobby McFerrin's, you know, like six Bobby McFerrin's, because they can do all these different really cool things with their voice. And so what you'll hear, you'll be like, how do they make those sounds, you know?
That's cool. Good reason to come. Mm-hmm. So Diane Reeves... again, kind of a legend. She might be close to 60, definitely in her 50s, so she's been around. She's been singing a long time. Mm-hmm. How would you encapsulate her style or her contribution?
Well, I think she's modern yet traditional. I think, you know, I think that she has, you know, certainly her own voice, but, you know, it also harkens back to an Ella Fitzgerald or a Sarah Vaughan. You know, I think, you know, when we thought about the year of the song, we were looking at you know, vocalists and specifically female vocalists, and, you know, we're like, Diane Reeves, I mean, she's kind of at the pinnacle of her career and she's singing great. And many people maybe saw her at the APA finals and a small part of what they did there that night. And so we were thinking, man, let's bring her back. Let's get some more of that for Indianapolis and let's bring her back with her own group. But I think what you're going to see is that, you know, again, while it is, you know, rooted in tradition of the music, it's going to be fairly modern. She's got a hard-hitting band. It's not going to be a soft, sleepy concert. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be very dynamic and very engaging. So I think that's the main reason why we picked her.
Yeah.
Love that.
She has a really great band. And, you know, it's to our advantage that I think when she first came on the scene, she was kind of a commercial artist, you know, so... She had a lot of name recognition, and then she moved more towards being more traditional, straight ahead jazz as she got a little older. So we like the fact that people know her name, Diane Reeves. You say it like a lot of people say, oh, I've heard of her. You know?
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, that's one of the challenges for you guys, for anybody behind the scenes putting together a festival, is that balance between here are artists that you should know and maybe you don't, but we want you to trust us to come out and check them out. But you still have to have those kind of a household name or two
right.
to get people to try you. Right.
I'm still trying to win that trust over. Because you get the people saying, hey, trust me, this is good. And they're like, I got to know who it is. I got to recognize the name. So,
yeah.
And we're just like, okay, we're going to have the guy from the Sunny D commercial come out. Oh, I heard that.
Name recognition does not equal talent necessarily.
So there's a balance of like, I mean, a lot of times it's like, okay, well, this guy's well known and his music is not so great, or this guy's great and not so well known, and this guy is known pretty much and his music is awesome, let's get him.
Yeah,
you know, that's usually the way it works.
And I think we've struck both this year. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, with Take Six, obviously phenomenal, you know star-studded, you know, group of guys that can really, really sing, and the name recognition to boot. And the same with Diane Reeves. And then the last one of the Sunset, I keep saying Sunset Signature Series, is Jonathan Butler.
Yeah, tell us more about him. So he's South African born,
yep,
but lives in the United States.
Yeah, I believe he's out in L.A. or something now. But yeah, I mean, he's really big, kind of in the contemporary, albeit smooth jazz kind of idiom. Mm-hmm. So, and that's something that does very well in Indianapolis. And you know, we've chosen to grab him because we feel like he has kind of both. You know, he has the musical prowess to be able to excite the true jazz listener, but also is making it accessible and you know, plays great, and he actually sings a little bit as well.
And
so,
he's like a singer songwriter instrumentalist, kind of does it all.
Right,
and he kind of does fit into that smooth jazz category. I mean, in America, we have to categorize everything, you know. So he's kind of been in the smooth jazz category, but he's had a lot of success and for years, multiple years, not like with multiple albums. So, you know, we feel like, you know, he's a really strong signature series artist.
Remind us what smooth jazz is.
Well, smooth jazz is kind of like the, I guess, a lighter version of fusion, fusion is when you take like jazz and pop or jazz and rock or jazz and any other genre and fuse it together. That's kind of what is known as fusion. Well, and then you take it a step further and say, okay, well, we're going to make it easy listening fusion. And that's what I think, you know, smooth jazz is. I mean,
that's a great definition. Kind of smooth those rough edges.
Yeah. So, I mean, Kenny G is probably the greatest, most well-known smooth jazz artist. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry if I stumble over my words. I was looking for the proper.
Yeah, no, that's
Kenny
a great
G.
definition. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Nice.
Good stumbling. Right. Well, you know, I think one thing that I always have been taken by as well is sometimes you listen to these guys' albums and you know, maybe for the more purist jazz listener, you may go, you know, okay, the meat's not there for me. It's kind of a glossed over version, like you said, kind of a light version of the fusion, but and I think what you see when they come and play live, these are all phenomenal musicians. So they're going to put on a great show. It's, you know, you talked about Feel Good earlier, and I think that's when we're looking at all these shows, we're trying to make sure that when you walk out of the show that you have felt like, you know, you've had an experience that is fun, it was exciting, was energetic. And so, you know, we want to bang people over the head with these shows because we want them to go back and support jazz all the time, which
absolutely
is what our mission
come
is.
Come out
so,
for other concerts, exactly, buy albums,
that's
buy
right
local too.
That's right.
In particular.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think that's where, you know, sometimes smooth jazz actually does get a little bit of a bad rap. But, you know, I've been to many smooth jazz concerts, you know, and they far more impressed me a lot of times than even the recorded music. So, you know, Jonathan Butler is going to be one of those guys that will knock you over the head.
And I realize just talking about the headliners of the Signature Series is only the tip of the iceberg for Indie Jazz Fest. There's so much more going on that people can find out about online, and also so much more going on than just September, because this is a festival that sort of virtually happens all year.
Right, year round, just like the schools in Indianapolis,
yes,
you know, a year-round schedule.
Jazz Fest has a balanced calendar.
Right.
but you are a not-for-profit organization. You've got a fundraiser coming up very soon as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's called Jazz on Canvas. I'll let him talk about the artistic part, but it'll be the 19th of July, mm-hmm, at the Jazz Kitchen. And just as conceptually what it basically is we've joined with about six or seven different artists, painters and photographers, and Rob and Nick and Steve Ali and Nick Tucker, Kenny Phelps, Marlon McKay, mm-hmm, have gone in the studio and recorded music to them. So this is all original music that's set to the tone of whatever the painting was. So I'll let him talk more about it because he was very involved in it. But
yeah, I mean, we thought it would be a great idea to take some visual artists and actually write music about the paintings. You know, it's kind of a concept that, I mean, if you've been to a Lincoln Center concert or something like that, or Kennedy Center, they'll have this big art piece on the wall and this commissioned work. And I said, let's do this with the artists here in Indianapolis. And last year we did it, and we had five artists last year. And it was, it turned out to be a great show. People, you know, were really into it. And so we wanted to take it a step further and say, okay, this year we want to make a CD of all the pieces of art. So not only if you buy the painting, which, you know, 50% of the painting will go to Indie Jazz Fest and 50% to the artist as a fundraiser, you'll get a CD to go along with it so you can listen to the art that's on your wall.
Sweet.
And then there's a story about it and say, well, this is what the artist was thinking. This is what the composer was thinking. You know, it's called Jazz on Canvas. And, you know, hopefully we'll have a lot of people show up. I hope you show up, too.
Sharon Gamble at the Indie Jazz Fest, Rob Dixon and David Ali. The festival's Jazz on Canvas fundraiser is on July 19th. Right now you're listening to a tune composed by Rob Dixon, inspired by a Rita Spalding painting for the fundraiser. You can find out more about all this at IndieJazzFest.net. Again, IndieJazzFest.net.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll chat with fantasy artist Lydia Burris about her upcoming show.
I'll get a preview of Theater on the Square's upcoming season.
And I'll find out about a new project called Streamlines. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.